Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Prepare Your Playbook to Obtain FDA Approval for Your Laboratory-Developed Tests. The presenters are Valerie Palmieri, CEO Founder, Momentum Consulting, Monroe, Connecticut, Jane Pine Wood, JD, Counsel, McDonald Hopkins, Dennis, Massachusetts, and Sheila Walkoff, JD, CEO and Founder, Goldbug Strategies LLC, Gaithersburg, Maryland.
Our slides have not been updated, so I'm sure as everyone knows, we are now dealing with a new rule. And we updated the slides.
But they're not loaded.
They're not loaded. So we did update them. So maybe at some point there might be updated slides in the materials. So please excuse the slides. So what we're going to do is I'm going to do a little bit of overview of how we got here. Obviously, there's some changes on the slides. Sheila's going to talk about ABCs of compliance, and then Valerie's going to start talking about how to operationalize and review the financial impact of the rule, and then have some time for question and answer. We're going to assume that many of you were at the session this morning or even at Dr. Stenzel's session a little while ago. We have a bit of a different perspective on things. And you know, we want to make sure that we're giving you as much information as we can right now, given our initial review. For anyone who's taken a look at the reg or the new rule, it is 528 pages or 523 pages. We certainly have done our best to review that, but admittedly, probably like no one else, has gone through every word in detail multiple times. So these are our initial impressions. Just as some background, you know, how did we get here? And again, my apologies. These are the old slides. Sorry, I have to stand in front. I'm not very good about standing in one place. A little less than 20 years ago, the FDA published draft guidance for regulations. It was never finalized. So we're going back like two decades at least, if not more, for the FDA looking at regulating LDTs, laboratory-developed tests. About 15 years ago, a little less, the FDA formally announced its intent to regulate all laboratory-developed tests. If we look about 10 years ago, we had draft guidance that was published by the FDA. Now, I have to admit, at that time, when nothing was ever finalized, a lot of people were like, oh, okay, this must be back burner. You know, some people felt as though some of the pressure was off in terms of the FDA's regulation of LDTs. In 2017, there was another discussion paper published, but we didn't see a lot of action from the FDA. And then in October, we had the proposed rule, and as we know, yesterday we had the final rule. But at the same time, it's important to recognize that in the last several years, we've also had a lot of legislative activity in this area. We had the Better Act, we had DEA, we had VALID, we have VITAL, we're still dealing with VALID again, there's still discussions regarding VALID. I don't really want to spend a lot of detail on that now because now that we have the final rule, I'd like to spend more time focusing on it. So in terms of, and again, I'm sorry, the updated slides aren't here. Where is the final rule and what do we need to think about it? You may have heard, and I'm already seeing things written out, that the final rule has carve-outs and grandfathering and exceptions in it. I think one of the messages we really want to bring home, particularly from a legal perspective, there is no grandfathering and there are no carve-outs, as one would think of those terms from a legal standpoint. The actual rule from the FDA, like the proposed rule, is very, very short. It is simply extending the definition of a medical device to include a laboratory-developed test. Everything else that we were concerned about under the proposed rule remains in the final rule. But the FDA said it will continue to exercise its enforcement discretion not to enforce certain aspects of FDA regulation. This is really important because you can't breathe a sigh of relief and say, oh, we're grandfathered, we have an existing LDT, or we have New York CLEP, we're grandfathered, we don't have to worry about it. One, that's not true because the enforcement discretion is not with respect to all aspects of FDA compliance, but what it also means is that the FDA has reserved the right to begin enforcement anytime it wants or to change that. So I think this is a very important message, because unfortunately the terms carve-out and grandfather, I think, are being used and giving people a bit of not intentionally a false sense of security, but people may start to adopt a false sense of security. If we look at the final rule, again, final rule basically says a laboratory-developed test is a medical device governed under the FDA rules. FDA goes on to say, as I explained, that it will exercise enforcement discretion in certain areas. There is enforcement discretion for Department of Defense, VA hospitals. There is enforcement discretion for academic medical centers or health systems that are performing testing only for their own patients where there is an unmet need. There is an enforcement discretion for tests that have New York laboratory licensure under the CLEP program. There is enforcement discretion for currently marketed laboratory-developed tests with only a little bit of flexibility for modification in the future under that enforcement discretion. There's also some enforcement discretion for what we call the pre-1976 laboratory-developed tests, basically manual tests. And Sheila will go into a lot more detail on these. But what's important to understand is the enforcement discretion, as described in the final rule, is not that they're not going to regulate those. What they're going to do is primarily, is for this time period at least, exempt them from the PMA application process, maybe have a quality systems light application, but generally they're still going to have to go through the labeling, the registration, still with some of the quality systems requirements. So even for those laboratories for which enforcement discretion has been indicated by the FDA, there's still things you have to worry about doing today, because the things that are the first on the timeline to become effective are the ones that will still be applying to all of these tests. So what I'm going to do is, do you think it makes sense that we go ahead and move straight to the rules, Sheila, if you're okay
sure.
with that? And then we may do a little back and forth, but in general, Sheila's going to go through what you need to start thinking about now in terms of compliance with the FDA rule. And again, our caveat is, like everyone else, we're in the process of reading it and digesting it, and then Valerie will weigh in. As we go through here, I'll probably just leave this slide up for a while, because I think this is the slide that is important, because it's the time frame. I mean, everything we're doing, we're looking at with respect to this slide. So, Sheila?
Yeah, you want me to switch
yeah.
to you?
Do you like it? Yeah, whatever's best.
I know I'm trying to read the updated slides from my from my technology here, but it's not too different. This the timeline is really important because with respect to the we put grandfathering in quotes or carve out in quotes because that's what everyone is talking about. But when you go through the rule, there are certain requirements. FDA is going to exercise enforcement discretion, for example, for the group of IVDs that are first marketed or LDTs that are first marketed before the final rule date, which they have anticipated to be published May 6th. What we've seen is a pre-publication view. And to the extent you are one of those, you have one of those, you're still going to need to comply with stages 1 and 2. And here, this was done, of course, before the rule. We were sort of estimating when that's going to be. But now we have exact timelines for these, and those are in our updated slides. But this is May 6, 2025, May 6, 2026. And so forth. So it's important, even if you don't think you're going to need a submission, and I heard my friend Tim Stenzel say earlier, if I were a lab, I'd be looking for ways to submit, and that's probably true. I mean, I've spent 20 years trying to help laboratories stay out of FDA, and those that want to go through or had to go through, how to make it through in a more efficient way. But to the extent that, and not the hospital labs, all labs are kind of in with this first and second, this is really a question of what does this still really mean? If you are under New York, you actually have to do first, second, and third stage. So this is going to be really important to focus on. And one of the things that we're going to be doing, like we said and Jane said, these are first impressions, but how do those things overlap? You're on the market now, you have New York, you may be conditional approval, Do you have to go all the way to 3 if you're using your New York as your sort of safe harbor, or you know, do you only have to go to 2? And that is a significant difference, because this is a full QMSR compliance quality system for the lab and for the LDT, and this is very similar if you've gone through IVDR. But FDA in January adopted a final rule, I think Tim spoke about that earlier too, adopting ISO 13485. And that is a rule for medical devices. And when you're coming from a lab background and a CLIA background, CLIA is not going anywhere. So this is on top of what CLIA requires, but you've got this whole medical device terminology that you have to integrate into your clinical lab, and we're calling it the unicorn, how to do that, because what we're trying to do is figure out how to leverage what's in the lab, because that's not what FDA helps you with, right? They don't tell you how to do this. So these are the things that you're still going to need to pay attention to, even if you don't have to go as far as 3, if you're not just using the New York exemption, because you can certainly, over this whole period of time, continue to put LDTs on the market. It's just that, you know, if you put it on May 1st of 2025, you better be ready to comply here. You just have to keep your compliance up as you go. As, you know, Tim was saying, if you're here and you're putting a new LDT on and you get to here and you get New York, right, you might be able to stop there. But I don't know, I think New York is going to get even busier than they already are. If anyone's had the experience of going through New York, I would say I've had less challenging experiences going through FDA with some of my clients that are labs. But anyway, so what else does this mean for those that are sort of in this, the safe harbors, if you will, of enforcement discretion? You know, either your hospital. Oh, sure. Sorry about that.
I usually yell, so I'm also really bad at staying in one spot.
There's a level here.
Oh,
right here.
Right here. Sheila. Right here. Oh, that's okay. I can just hold this. I can kind of talk and move. But all right. So as I was saying, like if you're thinking, how do I kind of stay out of FDA as long as possible? Which frankly, I think is something to be thinking about for sure. What does that mean, and what level of risk are you willing to accept? Because FDA is going to enforce, and they're going to enforce in kind of like a haphazard way to send a message. But you need to be thinking, okay, if I'm going to take one of these safe harbors. Or carve-outs, as people have been calling them, what kind of documentation do I have to prove that I actually am under that, you know, carve-out when FDA comes calling? And what they can do now, they have new tools like remote regulatory assessment where they can say, okay, LabX, just send me all of your documentations, because here under the second stage, you have to, you know, not just comply with the first MDR, the adverse event reporting, corrections, removal. All of this has to do with in the medical device framework. You also have to comply with records. So you're going to be expected to have this documentation in FDA. If they ask you for it, you're going to need to comply. You definitely want to avoid opening your laboratory door and finding FDA there with the U.S. Marshals Service with their weapons. And that actually does happen to some labs, so we want to avoid, no one looks that good in orange. So that is our goal. But to the extent that this is vague, you know, the rule has kind of generalizations, this really leaves a lot of discretion to the agency, and it doesn't really help all that much when you're trying to determine, am I in compliance or not? What is my minimal level of compliance, or any of these other questions? So, the other thing I wanted to point out was, too, is something that the rule did that hasn't been discussed that much yet, and we're all kind of just still processing it, but this requirement for labeling, what does that even mean? So you hear, oh, you have to register and list with FDA, and on the surface, you Google registration and listing with FDA, and it says, you know, you have to put your establishment information in. That's, you know, registering your establishment, the address, who's responsible. Then you have to list your entire menu of products that you're offering. You also will have to submit your labeling, and what that means is all of the advertising and promotional claims you're making about your tests, and in addition to that, FDA stated in the rule that they're going to request that you also send a summary of all of your performance data, your validation data, that supports each and every one of those claims that you are making in public-facing documentation. And then they've gone on to say, which was a little so surprising to me, honestly, that I read it 3 times, and I think it's on page 67, although the pages are now really blurring together. We were all in flight when this thing happened, and we're freaking out. But they go on to say, not only do you have to submit that kind of full labeling, which is an FDA medical device terminology, that we're going to make that public, and, you know, they are assuming that your competitors are going to keep an eye on that, kind of on FDA's behalf. They've sort of expanded their enforcement resources by inviting your competitors to take a look at that, review that, and to alert FDA if perhaps they don't think that your sensitivity and specificity really supports you making a claim of, you know, aiding in diagnosing Alzheimer's disease. So this is not to be taken lightly. And we were saying this before, it's very strategic because also when you register and list, you sort of declare what's my risk classification. When FDA talks about risk, they're not talking about level of complexity. They're talking about the risk of a false result to the patient. And that's how they determine your regulatory path. So for two reasons, you need to be thoughtful in what you are submitting. But every single lab under this rule has to meet stages one and two. If you're going under New York, you also have to meet three. So you might have also heard, too, like, okay, some modifications. This is the test that's kind of in this point in time. It's not quite clear what's a major modification, what's a minor modification. Really, FDA can kind of define it as they go, as they've done for some time. But to the extent that we can try to kind of lock that down, at least something to rely on, it's not a lot. You know, you go to add a claim, something like that. That's a change in intended use. That requires a submission. So you only get this run room, and that's why we were talking about it earlier. It's not really grandfathering or so much of a carve-out. You just get extra time before you have to fully go all into this. And so, you know, as one of my colleagues, who I was not even, I don't see her here, but she had the greatest, oh, there she is. She's stuck way in the back, Uliana. Mm-hmm. Came up with this amazing, I have to give her credit, this great analogy because I needed some new ones. I've been talking about this for many, many years. But, you know, there's no free cheese unless it's in a mousetrap. And that is exactly what you should be thinking of when you read this rule. There's that cheese. It looks really appetizing. You can nibble around the edges, but you take too big a bite and you're going to get smacked. And that's really the kind of the way it's been. But now FDA has a way to narrow down. I'm going to just give you a little bright side because I'm always like the grim reaper. A little bright side to this, and then I'm handing it over to Valerie. But the bright side of this is, you know, there are also tools that you can use when you eventually, either sooner rather than later, depending on, you know, where you are in your regulatory, you know, the application. It's really important to understand how does this rule apply to me and my product suite, and, you know, how do we, you know, have a business strategy that's going to take you beyond this. But if you're a lab or an LDT, you have an LDT, you know, really thinking, what do I need to do to minimize my risk, you know, as we go forward? But one of the bright sides is when you have a quality system in place, FDA views that as a significant risk mitigating factor. And so to the extent you make a modification, and you can do it under your quality system, like documenting the change, you know, change as you go along in a systematic way, you'll be able to say to FDA, well, I did that, but the risk is minimal because of here, and you may not end up with a public warning like they do with some laboratories. The other side of that is if you're not a laboratory and you are selling things that are labeled research use only or RUO, the rule is tangentially applicable to you, but the reality is you are already regulated by FDA. And as far as FDA is concerned, you're misbranding, and that is a big problem. And so that was the Agena Biosciences. I'm not sure. I think people haven't said the name, but it is public. I mean, you can Google it. But when you look through that, you can really see, where does FDA notice you? Your public-facing documents, your advertising and promotional materials. The same things that you are going to have to submit to FDA, every single lab for every single LDT, to explain what you're doing, and they'll apply their own AI and pick out words and then decide who to enforce against. And they only need to enforce against a few to really, you know, it's like the policeman on the side of the road, everybody slows down. It's kind of what they do here. So, but as I said, when you do put the effort into putting a quality system in place, and I never thought I would even know what an SOP meant, but we've seen the value of it when you get further down the line because you can use that to make your process going through FDA less burdensome, and you can use it to set forth, you know, your change controls so that you don't have to make as many submissions to FDA. So there's some bad and there's some new things that are available. And with that, I know we have kind of limited time. I'm turning it over to Valerie to tell you the next step, and then we'll do our Q&A.
All right. Let's see if I can get these slides advanced.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to discuss how to operationalize the mousetrap. The mousetrap, as we discussed this morning, and you heard some of the insights from the panel, but really looks at a five-point plan. And it starts first, and I can tell you from consulting, so I have an anatomic pathology molecular background, leading very large labs, selling labs, raising capital. It starts with your end in mind. So what is your end in mind in terms of your exit strategy? Then building a three-year model. I don't believe in five-year models anymore. This world, maybe it's even a two-year model. But what is your strategy today versus your exit strategy tomorrow? So are you going to do an IPO? Are you going to merge with a strategic? Are you looking for M&A? And then third is, how do you operationalize a three-part plan? So as we talked about, number one is QMS, your quality management system. I can tell you from being a CLS that the CLIA system of quality is not the same, and having cleared two FDA-cleared devices is not the same as an ISO 13485 at all. So just make sure, as CLIA lab personnel or leaders here, that you truly understand ISO 13485. It'll be a wake-up call, number one. Number two is your clinical validation. As you look at your QMS, the clinical validation going forward to innovate, to create new tests, modify your existing tests, that clinical validation is much more rigorous under an IVD than CLIA. It's very similar to New York State, but if you do not have a New York State CLEP, you really need to understand what that clinical validation is. And do you have the specimens to validate? Do you have the personnel to validate? We're all running on shoestring budgets. And then third is your team. Now you have a QMS system. Guess what? You're not going to look at just outsourcing your regulatory. You have to live, eat, and breathe this quality management system. It goes down to your advertising. It goes down to your branding on your website. It goes down to your day-to-day controls. So we're going to talk about that. Then we're going to look at categorizing your tests into high margin, import plan, export plan. I really think this is a time for aggregation. So if you have a rare disease, think about how you can pull in more tests into that rare disease. And you become that, I'm going to say, that center of excellence. Export plan, are there just anchors of tests that you have that are just bogging you down? And then last but not least is reconfirming it. So here's all the thought process that goes behind this. As I said, do you have an exit plan? Have you identified your value drivers, your high-value tests? How can you reduce price reductions and cost increases? Number three, I think, is the most important. What's your QMS foundation today? Your clinical data gaps, be ready for that. Your team. You didn't have to have that core team. And I can tell you from just running CLIA Labs, majority of us don't have that FDA experience, and that is a different rigor. That you really need to, as I said, need to live and eat and breathe in the organization. Number four is thinking back and saying, okay, what are the high margin tests we need to keep? What are those that we should be potentially importing, looking at partnering, aggregating, or maybe we're shedding load, right, so that we can build? And number four, I'm always like, as a carpenter, you measure twice and you hit once. Reconfirm your model. What was your model that you thought you had? Did you identify your top risks? What are the upsides and what are the downsides? So you can put sensitivities in that model. So that is just my kind of quick and dirty way of kind of looking at your business. I also think the key thing here with this new ruling is, as we said, there is no grandfathering, no carve-out. But as laboratorians, we have to continue to innovate. So FDA will become part of our lives. So for any new test, right, we've got to indoctrinate this new policy. Any modification, let's say you move from a certain technology, from technology A to technology B, that's a modification. So understand that modification definition very clearly as well. So I'm done with my section. We can open up the floor for Q&A. And these are really our survival tips. So we want to identify your transition gaps, learn your risks, act strategically, so you're looking at your entity in a strategic fashion, anticipate the burden. Be upfront with, as a especially on the pathology side, there's only so much one person can do. So there's a human component. How can you anticipate the burden of what this place and don't delay? This is actually an older presentation.
Yeah, it wasn't even the last one.
Yes. So we had a QR code where you guys can actually, so please when you get your, Robert will give you a list of all these presentations. There's a QR code between Sheila's Goldbug Strategy and the Momentum Consulting that you can take a LDT checklist and you can actually have that checklist for your labs and set up time to speak to us if you'd like individually. So we want to open up the floor for Q&A.
And also, right before we open up, there are a couple of things I just wanted to stress for people who are coming from a CLIA world and not the FDA world, because a lot of the discussion that's been going on with laboratory organizations has very much focused on, if we go back to that slide that had the five elements, you know, it's what if you have to go through back, I guess, the
timeline slide.
The timeline. You know, and so many people are looking at, you know, 4 and 5, and what do we have to do in 4 and 5, and really thinking about this from a laboratorian standpoint. You know, who are the personnel, who are going to be the research, the academics, the scientists to assist with that? But it's very important to remember what we're really talking about here, 1, 2, and maybe some of 3, mm-hmm. are very significant, and as both Sheila and Valerie said, this is not just your laboratory operations. It's not just your quality assurance. This is getting down to your sales level. Mm-hmm. This is the training. This is the messaging. And if I think about how laboratories operate right now, day in and day out, our competitor just sent out this message. Now we're going to do the same thing. That kind of last-minute pivoting
can't happen.
You're going to have to keep these reins on your sales staff in a way you've never had to do mm-hmm. before, because they just can't go out and wing it with messaging. I'm not saying that they're all winging it with messaging right now, but I think everyone here knows what I'm talking about, and that people will go out and salespeople will adjust their messaging based upon what the marketplace and what they're hearing and what they're hearing other competitors. Those days will be gone, because even in this watered down rule, it is watered down from what I would still say, if you're dealing in a CLIA world, was a very, very high bar. And even though Dr. Stenzel said it's now a low bar, I don't think it's a low bar by any means if you're coming from a non-FDA world.
Yes, and just from living, eating, breathing it, it's going to come down to even sales training. It's going to come down to getting feedback from your customer service and documenting a complaint. So it is a whole level of documentation that you've got to ensure the whole quality improvement process and everyone in the organization is accountable. So very different. In the CLIA lab, you could run things off your hip. There's no more of that. And as Sheila pointed out, they're going to be looking at your websites and your competitors. So they're looking for the competitors to report you to potentially the FDA.
And I'll give you a great example of something that actually happened with, in terms of this whole question of make sure you have your salespeople trained. So you might be up, you know, we deal a lot with the C-suite and we're talking about the strategy and how we can keep this particular company generally out of FDA for these, you know, 5 reasons. And then I get this random call. Our salespeople were at a conference. They started talking to somebody and the person gave them the business card and they sent it to us because it says FDA on it. And of course, it's really important to know who you are talking to when you're at your booth. So I said, all right, send it over. I mean, it could just be somebody who was attending. I think it was was an AACR, it was something else. And, you know, it's like maybe they were just, I mean, these FDAers are scientists. They're people. They are interested in these things. So it could have just been, you know, somebody interested, sends it over. No, it's the head of compliance. And I was like, I do know this person. And we now have a very different message to FDA. And they were like, what? I mean, it cost this company a lot more. We had to shift gears. We had to go in. You know, we had to explain what they were doing and why it wasn't what they thought, you know. And it just was this whole big thing. And it's still not resolved. So, you know, it just, FDA is a big organization. They regulate over 30% of the economy and they pay attention. And one of my more infamous clients, 23andMe, before I represented them, you know, probably they were advertising in Washington and I heard this and I'm thinking, what if
FDA is going to hear this. These are claims. I don't know that they can back these claims. This is back in 2011, 2012. And sure enough, you know, you saw their infamous warning letter. But those are rare. I mean, if it gets to a warning, a public warning letter, that's a huge problem. Whether you're a public company or a private company, you know, your investors are going to, and your board, they are, you know, as my sister would say, they're going to have a cow. I have all these analogies. But this is a major problem. And you can go on and read. I feel for Agena Biosciences because, you know, you can see what my concern was is, okay, they probably got a very soft outreach letter from FDA. They usually say, you know, it's come to our attention. We call them it's come to our attention letters. And that you are marketing this, and we think it might be a medical device, but we don't see you in our registration and listing system. Can you please explain to us that you are not, or, you know, why you're not compliant? And it goes from there. And then they had the unfortunate probably luck of maybe not replying so well to FDA. It's very important. It's like when the IRS comes in to audit you. It's really important to have people who know how to talk to the IRS. Don't give them too much. Answer their questions honestly. But then they get into your lab, and you have people that are proud. They're proud to work there. They're proud of your assay. They're proud of the, you know, innovative work you're doing, the great things you're doing for patients, and they'll talk about that and on and on and on. And then you end up with a letter that's perfectly available on Google. So that's just my personal
reality
experience.
Check.
It wasn't so bad as the one with the orange jumpsuit. That also did happen. So we try very hard to make everybody, just demonstrate to FDA that labs are focused on compliance or focused on quality assurance. They just speak a different language, but not for very much longer. So,
all right, well, let's open the floor for questions.
You said soft letter. My experience is that the softer it seems soft, the harder the follow-on really.
Yes.
I do consulting in the pharmaceutical field, and usually they'll have a letter with five or six questions, and the last one will be this very soft, very not. It almost seems like it's not an afterthought, but that's actually what they're going to get you on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a template form. It's come to our attention letter. And why I say soft is because that's how it's received by anyone. And as we talked about, it's unusual for a laboratory, one, to have ISO 13485, unless you're doing something with KIT or out of the United States, or two, to have anyone with regulatory experience that understands really what to read between the lines. They're not just curious when they send you that letter. They have already researched you. They already have the evidence. They already know what they're going to do. It's just a matter of how you respond, how bad it's going to be. So, you know, as a wise person anywhere gets, you know, in any world of the medical devices, IVDs, LDTs, that gets in case, you know, it's come to our attention, you should, as you said, it's not, it might feel soft because you don't know what you're looking at, but it's not going to be.
I have a two-part question. First of all, when you do IVD right now and you make a modification, you have to go back into the PMA and you have to pay fees to make enhancements. So like normally your LDT, you would do your own enhancements, document those in your record and everything else. Now you're going to have to go back every time.
Maybe.
Well, that's what we need to find out is on the modifications. And then looking at that cost, have you put together what the costs are going to look like, where people should be budgeting today to make 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
You want me
I think it's a two-part question. One, I'll repeat the question. So modifications, you're going to have to, do you have to go back through the PMA process? So the definition of modifications is in that 528-page document, needs to be studied. There are certain caveats, but in general, modifications does mean going back. So I just want to say that's point number one. Point number two, in terms of cost, the estimated cost, depending on where you are, right, in the process, do you need a QMS system? Do you have to clinically validate additional validation? Do you have the team, right? That, in addition to going for the clearance, could be, you know, and we've just put some softball numbers together, could be $1 to $2 million.
Per test.
Interestingly, the FDA estimated that the benefit from the rule would be between $1 and just under $13 billion, the benefit. They estimated the cost to the industry of $500 million to about $2 or $3 billion, I forget. Mm-hmm. Those numbers are like total.
Grossly,
Sheila, do you want to add anything to it?
Yeah, I was just going to say sort of specific. So your question kind of, is this on? I'll just take this.
We can hear you.
I'll carry this around because I feel like, you know, Vanna White. I'm unfolding each of these, you know. If only, then I wouldn't have to be dealing with the FDA rule year after year for most of my life. But so we talked a lot because we're talking about carve-outs and exemptions, kind of these first three. But there are a lot of reasons, and I have numerous clients that you actually do need to go to FDA. I mean, that's how you're going to your business model is going to really take off. So, you know, you're talking about something that's kind of already over here. There is a new tool. We hear a lot about valid and technical certification, and I heard Tim say something really a great observation. What we saw was really the technical certification in the legislation really helped the IVD manufacturers more than it would help the labs. What's helping the labs ultimately when you get down to this area and IVD manufacturers is something called a predetermined change control plan. And so a PCCP, and as my colleague who came up with the amazing cheese analogy will say, they joke that I'm the PCCP cheerleader. I think whenever you get to here, and eventually anyone who's offering a test that's marketed now will get to here, because modifications, there are certain guidances you can read that will explain FDA's view of modification. You know, we're going to do a deeper dive into this rule to see how that plays out in, you know, in terms of staying in this zone, the earlier zone longer. But a predetermined change control plan is something you work out with FDA within a submission. So you can't really do it over here. You have to get here. What will help you stay out of FDA trouble, if you're trying to stay out of FDA, is making changes, as you mentioned, consistent with your quality system and documenting those changes. Mm-hmm. Documentation keeps the, FDA nightmares away. It really helps a lot. It doesn't cure, but it helps. But if you get to this point, you're making a submission, you should never make another one without one of these. And we had the pure luck, honestly, of working on one of the first templates with FDA right after this authority came through. It was passed at the end of, like, December 29th, 2022. And it is so much broader than tech certification, so much broader than even most people at FDA are really contemplating at the beginning. So, you know, it does not prohibit changes in intended use, but right now, just about any change creates a new assay as far as FDA is concerned. You change the specimen type, you add a new population, you go from, you know, 18 and under to, you know, or 18 and over, it's, you know, change the definition of pediatric population. Anything can really create. One time we had a lab that changed reagent manufacturers, new test, you know. You're a single-site assay, you change an instrument, same instrument family, there is a guidance, but if you don't document it right, new LDT, you're out of that safe harbor. But if you have a PCCP, this I've seen in action now is the closest way that you can, you know, get back to doing things kind of like you did before as a lab. I don't think it's as helpful, honestly, to IVD manufacturers because we haven't seen it play out yet. But if you put that in place, you know, what you're doing is anticipating that you're going to be making these changes. So the one I worked on, it actually enabled this company to continue to add variants over time and cancer associations. Even though you'll hear people say, oh, you can't change the intended use and things, it really depends on how you're doing it. But the key to that, which is kind of like the FDA gives it and then they snap your head off and take it back, you need this quality system. You, not what you have on Media Lab right now. You need an ISO 13485 quality system because within that PCCP, you have to reference specific SOPs on how you are going to do this. Very different from what FDA, if anyone has FDA experience, typically the pre-market side of FDA does not really focus on quality systems. It's all post-markets and inspections. But there's two places where pre-market has really started to look at this. A big one is the PCCP. And we now know sort of what the FDA is looking for with that. It's pretty comprehensive. The other one is the breakthrough designation, which is a talk for another day. But does that help answer your question? It's really, though, how you maximize it and make use of it, the benefits you can get from not having to go back in submission. Go ahead, Jane.
So we were looking right before this, again, at the definition of what would be a permissible modification if you have a current LDT. And as we were looking through this, again, need to think about it, but it seemed as though the FDA could, it was so narrow, just about anything you do could be deemed an impermissible modification. Mm-hmm. I mean, as we were looking at the language, it was not giving any of us a great deal of comfort.
Yes. because we worry about your risk.
Yeah.
Well, I've been in where we had companion diagnostics, and I was on the pharma side. Mm-hmm. And then the laboratories, the kit itself needed to be upgraded.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so they needed a hybridization step on the mm-hmm. front end. And so we had to, the lab was doing the hybridization step, therefore taking it out of FDA approval mm-hmm. companion status. And the IVD manufacturer would never go make the change because the cost didn't mitigate that
right.
because it was moving and
correct.
Transitioning to new technologies. Mm-hmm. So the lab had to still do it because they knew they were losing patients from QNS, mm-hmm. right? So that's why it's like, what's going to make this easier for laboratories to do the modifications, because they actually had a better test than the FDA-approved test.
Yeah, just review that modifier section.
Okay.
Interpret it, because it, to Jane's point, it seems to be all-encompassing. If you anticipate an adverse reaction, right, would you make a change to have it be adverse?
Yeah.
Right?
But
so
that,
it's really it's worded very holistically to include as much as possible.
And really, what is adverse, right?
Right.
Is it you've increased the sensitivity, but naturally would have, you know, decreased the specificity? Would that be
that's
considered?
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something correctly. Anyway, I know you had another.
Out of this process, is the routine stuff we do in AP, like bringing up new IHC stands and stuff, is all of that
all here?
No.
What?
It's all included.
It's all in here.
Yes.
So you might not have to do, like, you might have to get down to here, and so it, you know, say you have a IHC staining test that's comes under an FDA, like it's class one exempt. That's a risk classification. You'll decide that in stage two. Well, according to FDA, so you may have to do certain things and document, but you may not have to make a submission for it, but you're still under all of this.
Yes.
That's the thing. That's the rub about this grandfathering and carve out that we are like now really
yes.
coming to terms
you have
with.
To register.
Yep.
Unless it's FDA cleared. So if you're using an FDA cleared.
Well, you still have to register if you're
no.
FDA cleared.
Okay.
But.
No, but it's, or if you're running an
if
FDA
you're running
cleared,
an FDA,
FDA
oh,
cleared
yes.
test,
yes.
if you're running an FDA cleared test, you're okay.
With
so
no
something that's out of the box, no dilutions, no modifications.
Right.
If you're using
that's
RUO,
the only way to stay
you're
clear.
Creating your own specials or IHCs, yes, all anatomic pathology, which is huge. Huge.
So, you know, one quick
anatomic
thing.
Pathology is an art.
On New York, I just want to add a little piece to that. So, you know, you also are hearing a lot about, okay, just go under New York, you can stay under New York. That's true. I mean, according to this rule, we're still not sure how that lays over with what's marketed
yes.
now. But say you have this assay, you decide, I want to avoid this. I still have to do 1, 2, 3, but maybe it's class 2, you find out when you register, which you really get some help with that for sure. You don't want to, that's a key place for enforcement for FDA. So you find out, okay, it's class 2 exempt. I just need to do this certain documentations. I don't have to actually make a submission. Or no, maybe I do. Maybe it's class 2. I think I'd rather go through New York and just stay out of FDA down here entirely. I don't want to do a pre-market submission to FDA. So you can do that, but as you heard Tim say earlier, you have to wait until you get at least the conditional approval from New York before you can offer it. And then there's a piece of paper that's publicly available to say what your New York clearance covers or your
right.
conditional approval, I mean New York approval or conditional approval covers. And if FDA takes a look at what you've registered and listed and what you're advertising in your current website and it says something different than that certificate, right there that you're no longer covered under that safe harbor. So a lot of devil in the details here and nuances,
mm-hmm.
same with academic medical centers. You know, if one LDT goes through as a single site way down here and gets an approval, and then, well, no longer an unmet need because you now have something available. Yeah, it's not a kit. You can't bring it into your academic medical center lab and run it as a kit like, you know, the way that you can do this to standard CLIA. But you can send your samples out to this lab across the country that does have this single site, you know, Foundation or Guardant. So, you know, that's a big hit if you're an academic medical center lab or hospital lab. And who's going to pay attention to that? You know, Valerie and Jane both, they talked about burden, about being prepared. Somebody has to monitor the clearances and approvals that come out from FDA every week or every day sometimes, but, you know, at least weekly to know, are you in or out of compliance? So, That's I'll leave it there because I'm getting faces like, oh my God, she's she's really killing us today. So
I think to Sheila's point, in terms of, you know, obviously our presentation changed when our planes landed yesterday and we looked at our phones and realized the final rule came out. But this is not a task where someone in your laboratory draws the short stick. You have the meeting, and, oh, Joe's not here today, so Joe's going to be the person who has to worry about this, you know, because the rules are complex. And this is one of those areas in particular where the words matter.
Every word.
And the words, particularly in number two, are going to matter a lot and have implications that you'll have to live with. So don't just give it to someone to have to do by himself or herself in a room somewhere. This really is going to be a team, and there are some decisions and probably a lot of discussions to be had. Because to Valerie's point, what is your end game for your laboratory? What are you planning to do? You also need to think, what do I want to do with this test? Because that plays into, I don't want to say what games do you play with words, because lawyers don't play games, but, you know, however you word it in number two has implications, but you have to think about what do you want to do with your lab, what implications do you want?
Yes. Well stated. I think we're over. It's at 3:33. We have a couple of minutes.
Oh, we do?
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Question, I think there's a question over here.
Yeah, so my question was, how do you deal with high-complexity NGS-based tests? Where the manufacturer comes tomorrow at Illumina, oh, I have a new agent, you know, I'm replacing V2 with V3, right? I have a new updated software, right?
Yes.
And this is a big problem, right? Because
yes,
they're going to change.
The innovation, they improve accuracy.
That's what we talked about, this being a mousetrap. So this is a mousetrap.
It's too big a bite of cheese.
Yes, it's a mousetrap. So everything going forward will have to comply.
I mean, for a lot of the vendors, what will be interesting is, because we've talked a lot about what's the impact upon the laboratories, but a big issue is what is the impact upon the manufacturers? I mean, we talked about the Agenia letter that came out, but that also changes how they're going to have to approach their clients, all of you in the room, because they are not going to be real popular if all of a sudden they're bumping you into 4 and 5.
And or put them in
that.
4 and 5, let them already clear the test,
right,
and then give it to us.
Because that's the thing. That rep is coming to you, and I'm sure that's not a cleared or approved, you know, reagent for that particular use, and saying, this is what you can use it for. That is what FDA calls misbranding, and that is a big, big problem for them. And so, you know, it's kind of like every single thing has the dark side of the moon and the light side with this with FDA, but you know, my concern when I saw that RUO manufacturer enforcement on those panels is that I don't want supply to come, you know, to be restricted coming into clinical laboratories right when you're going to have to try to validate. And 100%, you will need more validation data for FDA, analytical and clinical. I've never seen a lab come through that did not need more studies when they go through FDA. So you should just, you know, as Valerie said, plan for that burden.
Yes.
But in terms of that, I was worried about, okay, they're going to crack down on anything labeled RUO. It's still okay for a clinical lab to use RUO components in there. But the seller, the problem is they can't advertise it to you that way. But how are they going to sell their product? So they're going to come in and try to strong arm you. But they're at risk now because you could just, everyone tattles, let me tell you, everyone. Be aware that your biggest competitor is also your biggest risk for being called enforcement. But if, you know, if they have people going back and saying, oh, they're coming in with their sales team, believe me, the higher people at Illumina, and I know Jay Flatley finally retired, who come to me every time, Sheila, we need to talk. We need to talk, but he retired. But whoever's replaced Jay, whoever's currently there, is not going to be happy if they have FDA, because they know what they're supposed to do for FDA. They are already a regulated entity. So at least you have some power back, a little leverage.
Cut it. All right. So that's the last question. Thank you all for attending.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.